Now that we've made the introductions, we'll call the first case, 99-0380, Kaufman versus Lightfuss. And representing Mr. Kaufman is Linda, is it Isner? Counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please this honorable court, my name is Linda Isner, and I represent the plaintiff appellant in this case, Michael J. Kaufman. The primary issue presented to the court this morning is whether the collateral source rule applies to Mr. Kaufman's accident-related medical expenses without limitation to the amounts actually paid or subject to any subrogation interests at issue. Very recently, this court in Ellsworth versus Shellbrock addressed a very similar case and confirmed Wisconsin's recognition of the collateral source rule, which provides that a tortfeasor's liability to an injured individual is not reduced because the individual received benefits or payments from other sources. This court further upheld longstanding precedent that an injured victim is entitled to the reasonable value of his accident-related medical services as part of his compensatory damage claim. This court specifically rejected the actual reimbursement rate, which is the amount actually paid, as the benchmark for reasonableness. Rather, what is reasonable and necessary is to be proved by the plaintiff, and if controverted, determined by a jury.
I have a question. Why did the plan, now here the plan assigned their rights to you, is that correct?
Correct.
Yeah. Why did they do that? Is there a...
I'm not certain, Your Honor, and they obviously are not on the record today.
Okay, it's not in the record then.
No, so it's not.
That's why I... Okay.
No. I presume in such a case it's just so they don't have to continue to appear at trial.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, Mr. Kaufman represented their rights as well as his own rights with respect to the medical expense issue. The collateral source rule was applied in Ellsworth despite the existence of subrogation rights.
Counsel?
Yes.
It seems to me that the parties have framed this issue as whether or not the collateral source rule applies and have advanced arguments regarding that. I respond in thinking, well, of course the collateral source rule applies. No one seems to be disputing that for what was incurred in expenses, that the collateral source rule applies such that the plaintiff could recoup those monies, and then, of course, subject to subrogation, release that amount to the subrogated carrier, or here, the whoever has the subrogation claim. So it isn't a question of whether or not subrogation applies. It's a question of whether or not they can recoup the excess between the reasonable amount paid and what was incurred. Now, that's the way I see the issue. Do you agree or disagree, and why?
I absolutely agree with you. Unfortunately, the trial court judge did not agree, and on the record, his ruling was pursuant to this Lambert versus Wrench decision, which we argued had no application here because we had subrogated parties who were pursuing their subrogation interests, determined that the collateral source rule did not apply, and as a matter of law, the reasonable expenses should be the amount charged.
Well, that's two different things, it seems to me.
Correct.
Whether or not the collateral source rule applies, you know, that rule's been around for quite a few years, and it seems to me, and I don't want to put words in your opposing counsel's mouth, but no one's contesting that it applies as to the amount incurred. The question here is whether or not you can get the amount between what was incurred and what you deemed reasonable. So it isn't whether or not the collateral source rule applies. Or maybe whether it applies only to what would be referred to as the excess amount. Is that the way that you're framing the issue?
We have always contended that the collateral source rule applies, but I believe if you look at the defense's position prior to trial and during the appellate process as well, is that one of their arguments is that it does not apply. But going beyond that, yes, at least with respect to this case, what is at issue ultimately, if you will, is the difference between what was charged and billed for these services versus what was actually paid. This is very similar to the issue which was presented to the court in the Ellsworth case. So I agree with you. I believe the collateral source rule clearly applies, but the issue here is the essence of what should that amount be in these circumstances.
So it's a measure of damages case?
Yes, yes.
And everybody confuses it as a collateral source versus subrogation issue when they analyze it, which has sort of been going on for a number of years.
Yes.
And 1,000 years,
And I understand now, as I've looked back on the record, I understand why the trial court might have been confused. If you take some sound bites out of Lambert, which says if you have subrogation, collateral source rule doesn't apply. Well, that's not necessarily true. If there's any application to that case, in this case at all, which I contend it doesn't, that collateral source would be the excess amount versus the amount which was subject to the subrogation interest.
I have a question on Lambert, since you were talking about that case. Why shouldn't this court just broadly construe Lambert? In other words, is there any language in Lambert that limits it to these facts?
I believe, and it was very clear to me, and quite frankly, I was surprised what the trial court did with that decision, because I think that Lambert is very distinguishable on its facts. And in fact, there's subsequent cases which cite Lambert, which expressly limit it to the situation where you have a subrogated interest, which for some reason, most applicably in the situation where the statute of limitations ran. So now, should the plaintiff recover the full amount without forgiving that amount? In other words, this double recoveries type of issue. And that's not existent here. And so I contended and still contend that Lambert really has no application in this case, just like it would not have had application in the Ellsworth situation, where you had a subrogated, not a carrier, but the state of Wisconsin, a government entity, but nonetheless collateral source rule applied, but the amount which was subject to the interest came out of the total amount which was awarded in that case by the court, but in other cases might be a jury.
What are you asking for in this case? Do you want the amount the jury awarded? Do you want the amount that was testified to as the reasonable value of the services?
Mm-hmm.
And if you want the second, the latter, why do you think that's justified from a policy point of view?
What was difficult in this case is that the judge made the determination pre-trial that the collateral source rule did not apply, and therefore no evidence could come in beyond the amount which was actually paid. Also,
if that's true, how do you think the jury got to $98,000?
That's a good question. Because defense counsel argued for the $66,000 in rough numbers, which was subject to the subrogation interest for the amount actually paid, and the jury actually went beyond that and awarded another $30,000+. And I think if this court looks at the overall verdict, it is clear to me, perhaps not clear to you, I understand that the court is hesitant to look in the minds of a jury, but in this case where we had competing medical testimony, it is so clear to me that the jury adopted the opinions of plaintiff's treater, which was that there were three major cervical surgeries, which resulted in a 25% permanent disability.
Well, was there testimony that went to the reasonable value of the medical services being $180-some thousand?
That was stipulated, Your Honor. The only issue which was before the jury was whether those expenses were necessitated by the accident. And
was the jury aware of the stipulation? Was the stipulation read to the jury?
I don't believe so. I don't believe so. And it...
So was there any evidence in front of the jury about any amount other than the $67,000?
Ultimately, near or at the end of the trial, because necessity was disputed between the parties, it became clear to the court that if this evidence doesn't go to the jury, there'll never be a jury determination as to necessity. And so what happened was the judge agreed to now let in the medical bills and the itemization of special damages, as well as our medical testimony testifying as to the reasonable and necessity of those expenses. So what the jury heard, that's a long way of getting to answer to your question, Your Honor.
Here.
And that is, they heard the amount.
Right, okay.
And they... But the plaintiff could not argue entitlement to the difference between the 187 and the 66. On the other hand, defense counsel was allowed to argue the 66 should be the amount that should go in there, and they were allowed, the jury was informed that 66,000 was only the amount paid. And so what was left was this gap.
So they did hear two numbers.
Yeah. They heard two numbers, but there was no explanation was provided. Plaintiff could not argue why you should still give us the 187. In other words, in these cases, really, no evidence of the collateral source should have gone to the jury. The jury, that's traditional in prior case law. And what happens when, I guess this case is an example of what happens when a jury starts hearing about what gets paid versus what is reasonable and necessary. What's the value?
Well, no, the question of reasonableness and necessity in a personal injury case usually goes to the issue of whether the plaintiff was overtreated. Not, you know, whether the amount that was charged and paid, whether it's a discounted amount or whether it's full retail or something in between, is not the issue. The issue for the jury is usually whether the plaintiff was overtreated or whether there's a causal relationship between the amount of treatment and the tort. That's the issue for the jury. And so when the case was submitted to the jury in the way that it was, it seems to me they were obviously confused.
Well, and I think the fact that they then submitted a question, a written question to the court, saying, please tell us what was actually paid. And the court instructed them that the plaintiff paid thus and such. One subrogated carrier paid this much, and this carrier paid this much, the 66 in essence, I think heightened the prejudice of the whole situation. So what do I want you to do with this case? I think that the $98,000 is not a true representation of what is the necessitated value of these expenses.
You want the $187,000.
I believe that the record reflects that would be an appropriate reflection of what a jury would have awarded had it not received this extraneous prejudicial information.
And want this court to give you $180,000+.
Yes.
Not remanded.
That would be right.
That's true. Understanding that if we look at this case conservatively, that at a minimum, that's what this court should do, because that $98,000 is a tainted verdict. Because the jury heard information which is necessarily prejudicial to the plaintiff's case. On the other hand, I believe that there's very strong persuasive argument as to why this court, as a matter of law, could award the $187,000, especially when you look at the competing testimony between plaintiffs and defendants' medical experts. There was no middle road. You had our expert testifying that All these medical expenses were necessitated by this accident. On the other hand, you have defense counsel, defense's medical expert, testifying that these three surgical surgeries were not caused by this accident, but on the other hand, because of an underlying degenerative condition, and that there was no functional impairment as a result of this accident. And so to me, there is no middle road, and so the fact that this jury awarded $600,000 in past and future pain and suffering and loss of income persuades me that they believed plaintiff's expert over defense's expert.
But there really was no jury issue as to the value of those services. There was only a jury issue as to whether they were necessary and causal, right?
Well, the jury instruction I believe that was submitted was 1750A, which is similar to the 1756, but it's the special verdict special instruction. They should have been instructed that it's a, and that's what the judge should have done when they said who paid what. The judge should have said, no, you're to determine what's reasonable here, not what was paid. But because the judge had made this preliminary decision on motion in limine that it was going to allow that evidence, he misled the jury.
Let me get back, if I might, to the question I asked earlier. What policy reasons can you advance as to why there should be an award of $121,000 approximately, more than what was actually incurred? What justifies that?
What justifies that is the same policy that justified the decision which the majority of this court rendered in Ellsworth, and that is that Wisconsin's tort system, underlying Wisconsin's tort system, is to compensate the plaintiff for his injuries. And with respect to the collateral source rule, the public policy is to not allow a defendant to benefit from payments from sources which to the plaintiff that the defendant had nothing to do with. And so in a circumstance like this, if this court, for example, were to affirm what happened in the trial court, then what would happen is that the collateral source rule is not being evenly applied. And I don't believe that this court would want, I don't believe this. It should be the law in Wisconsin that the amount of an individual's medical expenses is dependent on what is paid or what is charged. Because I think past case law makes it clear that it should be the reasonable value. And the $66,000, in some sense, does not necessarily reflect the reasonable value, nor would it in any other case. And I believe in Ellsworth, this court actually rejected the argument that the amount of the payment is dispositive on this issue. So the policy is to treat plaintiffs the same, that if you have plaintiff who's a Medicare patient, plaintiff who's a Medicaid patient, plaintiff who's indigent, or plaintiff who has insurance coverage, the value of their medical expenses should be the same, regardless of who pays what and how much.
Would it be fair to say that damages can be broken into two categories of economic damages and non-economic damages?
Sure.
And the medical expenses we're talking about here, are those economic damages?
The court has categorized them as compensatory damages, which in essence would be non-economic, correct? I'm not sure how to categorize them. They've been categorized as compensatory damages. I guess there's an economic aspect of them in this case because you have a party who actually paid something. On the other hand, there is a non-economic aspect as well, and that's the value which may be on that actual paid amount.
Well, if this court should say it goes, I'm sorry, it didn't.
Go ahead.
If the court would say that this has to go back to a jury rather than this court, this is a follow-up to Justice Presser, then would all the damages go back or just the issue of medicals?
No, it really should just be the issue of medical expenses. The remainder of the verdict is not at issue on appeal and is not at dispute between the parties. It would just be the issue of medical expenses, but quite frankly, it would be like a trial in whole because you would have to have the plaintiff testify as to what happened and what his injuries were. It would be a retrial in essence of the entire case, but there would only be one verdict question as compared to a multi-questional special verdict which was used
previously. What did the defense experts testify as to the value of the services?
I don't believe there was any. Defense counsel can confirm. I don't believe there was any value testimony. He just testified that the injuries were not caused by the accident. I don't believe there was any testimony as to value or saying.
Are you saying that we can decide this case because essentially the issue of the value has not been contested? You put in testimony of $187,000,
right,
as to the reasonable value of those services. What you're telling me is the defense did not say that no, the value of those services was really only $50,000. What they were saying is these were all due to something else. These were not causal.
Correct. I believe the only argument that was made was that if the jury agreed that these injuries were caused by the accident, that the most they could award was the $66,000, which arguably could be the value position of defense counsel. But no, I don't believe the defendant's expert proffered any testimony as to specific monetary amounts.
Counsel, I want to follow up on Justice Babbage's question. It seems to me your argument is that the jury heard the medical expense that you advance of $181,000, but they heard it too late in the whole trial. So that they were already confused by what the judge did when he allowed the $62,000 to come in. Am I wrong on that, or am I tracking?
Yes.
Is that what your position is?
Yes and no. I mean, I can't contest that at late in the game that the judge allowed the actual amount to come in, notwithstanding that he tied plaintiff's counsel's hands. But
my point is this. I mean, the issue in part in this case is whether or not something in excess of what has been incurred should be recoverable by the plaintiff. Here you have a jury that came back with about $30,000 in excess of what has been incurred. Now, it's not the full $181,000 that you want, but the premise that you're fighting for must have been acknowledged. I mean, your argument, as I understand it, is, look, the jury was constrained by this $62,000. Well, obviously they weren't, because they came back with $62,000 plus $30,000. And then you had testimony, apparently, from the defendant's doctor that said, the accident didn't cause all of the injuries. So why can't the jury take that into consideration?
Sure.
And, listen to the testimony and see and hear the doctor's testimony that not all of the injuries are caused by this accident and adjust the medicals accordingly. I'm not sure.
I first would like to respond to the issue regarding incurrence of medical expenses, because my understanding that was a big issue in the Ellsworth case, and I think it was made very clear that incurrence does not necessarily mean there's an obligation to pay for, and that relates back to Thorson and McLaughlin, those cases where there's gratuitous payments. But having said that, Your Honor, the jury instruction says that when you award medical expenses, you're not constrained to the medical and hospital bills, that there are some additional awards that can come in for things like travel, prescriptions, etc. If this case had gone to the jury and the information regarding what was actually paid had not gone to them, I'm not so sure they might not have given more than the $187,000.
Well, suppose the jury decided that it was the reasonable value of these services was more than the $60,000+, right? There would be evidence in there for them to so hold, right?
Only because there was this exhibit which had $187,000 worth of bills in it, and plaintiff's counsel could not argue to the jury.
No, but there was evidence. So they think that it's worth more than the 66, it's worth like 187,000, but they don't think that all of that medicals are due to the accident. They think there were pre-existing conditions, right? And that therefore the defendant shouldn't pay for all of them. So they could have said 186 less what was not necessitated by this accident. Therefore, it's 98. Was there enough evidence to hold that for a jury to so find?
It's difficult for me to say, Your Honor, because the evidence was so slanted towards one side that I can't say whether that $98,000 jury verdict was necessarily reflected as to what this jury connected to this accident. And I'm particularly troubled with respect to the high award of, for example, future earnings losses and past pain and suffering, because to me those aren't a neck strain. These are serious cervical injuries, and so at this point we're kind of speculating. I don't think, given the overall verdict, that this jury was piecemealing these neck surgeries, and two might have been caused by the accident and one was not. Of course, we can't inquire into their minds, but I think the overall verdict is so reflective of a causal connection between the injuries and this accident that yes, I believe the $98,000 would not be reflective of...
Are you saying that there was no credible evidence to support the jury verdict that some of the medical costs that were incurred, some of the reasonable medical costs that were sustained were not sustained as a result of this negligent act?
That is my argument, Your Honor.
No, are you saying there's no credible evidence?
There is no credible evidence to support the verdict that the jury rendered in this case, particularly because...
But as I understand it, the defense witnesses said some of these, not all of these injuries were as a result of this accident. And I would assume that your experts said yes, they were, but there was something for the jury to weigh there.
Actually, defense expert testified in essence that most, if not all, of these injuries were not necessitated by this accident. If you look at the amount of medical expenses which followed this particular expert's treatment of the plaintiff, they account for about 95% of the overall $187,000. And so, again, there was no testimony from defense expert as to amounts that may have been versus were not. But if we go on his testimony that these three neck surgeries were not caused by this accident, that would be 95% of the medical expenses. And so I think that the evidence combined with the expert testimony causes a great shadow on this verdict, especially given the overall verdict. and I see my time has expired.
Yes, thank you. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
James Herrick, representing Jeremy Likens. Mr. Herrick.
May it please your honors, my name is James Herrick. I represent the defendants Jeremy Lightfuss and State Farm Mutual Automobile Insurance Company. This case was prepared and presented to Judge Buzley and to the jury based upon what we understood the holding and the law was in the state of Wisconsin regarding collateral source over here and the law of subrogation on the other hand. And it was our understanding that under Lambert versus Wrench, if you had an insurance contract with a provision for subrogation, if you had payment pursuant to that provision, and if that subrogation was not waived by the insurance carrier involved, that that cause of action for those medical expenses, whether it was 100%, 25% of those expenses or whatever, was assigned under law, taken from the plaintiff and assigned under law to the subrogated insurance carrier. Based upon that situation, what we had was Wisconsin Central, other than a few thousand dollars, took liability for $180-some thousand of medical expenses. Then Wisconsin Central went and made payment. We found out later on that the payment was $62,000. But when they took that liability and when that liability was satisfied by their payment, at that point in time, any liability that the plaintiff might have was extinguished. There was no remainder interest like in the Ellsworth case. And the subrogated carrier was in a position seeking reimbursement. The plaintiff, Michael Kaufman, received everything he asked for from the standpoint of medical expense. The Farmers Insurance received everything that it asked for as far as medical expense. The subrogated carrier received everything that it asked for as far as medical expense. The difference, the jury award, Judge Buzley reduced down to the amount that the subrogated carrier paid. And there's a good reason for that, because under this court's law, a subrogated carrier cannot receive more than they've paid. If you look at the record in this case, we stipulated that the amount of the bills, whatever they were reasonable. And we had no problem with that. But we also contested whether or not those bills were caused as a result of the accident, whether they were related to the accident, whether they're related to pre-existing conditions. We didn't know what the situation was, and so that much we contested. As the evidence went in on this, and then we brought a motion in limine, and we said to Judge Buzley, because of a Lambert Wrench case, there's no reason for the jury to make a determination as far as what the medical situation is, because we agreed that the plaintiff has incurred this, you should receive that. We agree that Farmers has incurred this, Farmers should receive it. And we agreed that the subrogated carrier, Wisconsin Central, received, paid this, and they should receive it.
Counsel?
Yes.
One of my favorite resource books is treatise called Law of Damages in Wisconsin. So in preparing for this case, I take a look at that. And I want to try to focus on your understanding of the law in comparison to what this treatise says. Now, of course, the treatise can be wrong or it can be right, but I just want to help define what the issues are. So under the collateral source rule, Section 3, 33.6, it says application of collateral source rule, tort claims. I want to know if you disagree or agree with these premises. A person injured by another person's tortuous conduct is entitled to be compensated by the wrongdoer for the plaintiff's total damages. Do you agree or disagree with that?
Yes, I agree.
Gratuitous benefits bestowed by others, including medical insurance payments or payments made pursuant to statute, workers' compensation benefits, for example, will not act to diminish the amount of compensation to which the plaintiff is entitled. Do you agree or disagree with that?
I agree unless there's a subrogation clause in a contract. There's payment made pursuant to that subrogation clause. Subrogation is not waived, and it's asserted, or, as this court held in the Jindra case, we establish it if we want it to be imposed.
Let me read just two or three following premises. The general rule is that a person who's been injured by another person's tortuous conduct is entitled to recover the reasonable value of medical and nursing services reasonably required by the injury. Do you agree or disagree with that?
I agree if it's owned. If that claim of relief is owned by that person as opposed to an assignment under law like we had in this case.
And this recovery is for the value and not for the expenditures actually made or obligations incurred. Do you agree or disagree with that?
I agree with that with one proviso, Your Honor. On page 108 of the Lambert case, the court approved allowing the trial court to submit evidence, allowing one of the parties to submit evidence as to what was actually paid on the medical expenses as evidence of what would be reasonable.
Well, let me add the final premise then here. An injured party can also recover for full medical expenses incurred even if that party's insurer settled its subrogation claim for less than its face value, citing this supplement is December 2000, so it's a couple months old, citing Reed versus Bradley, a very recent Court of Appeals case. Do you agree with that or disagree with that?
I do not agree with that under the circumstances of this case, Your Honor.
Okay.
And so we presented to Judge Buzley a motion in limine. We said that we're willing to agree that these payments should be made as far as medical expenses. That should drop out of the case. Somewhere along the line, two things happened. One, Judge Buzley apparently agreed to submit it or decided to submit it to a jury. And two, there was an assignment made. When Judge Buzley agreed to submit that to the jury, to my surprise, he read into the jury the deposition, those portions of the deposition of Dr. Maimon that had been excluded in the motion in limine. So that Dr. Maimon's testimony went in with Judge Buzley reading those portions of the deposition. Secondly, Exhibit 1 of the, which was a collection of all the medical expenses, went into evidence, and that went into the jury room. And the third thing is Judge Buzley says that the lawyers can argue whatever they wish to argue. It was our contention that no matter what the amount of the medical bills were, either the accident did not cause those expenses because there was no causal relationship between the injuries claimed and therefore the resulting treatment, and even Dr. Maimon himself conceded, and it's in the record, that Mr. Kaufman had pre-existing problems that preceded the accident, and that the treatment that he received in this case was in part to take care of that situation. We had an aggravation and effect of a pre-existing condition so that the accident was not the sole cause.
Mr. Herrick, given all of the information that you just recited that the jury had, why shouldn't we just uphold the jury award of $98,000? Why should we go back to 66 or whatever the figure is?
Your Honor, the only reason why we would ask this court to go back to the lower figure, the figure that Judge Buzley set, is due to the fact that when the subrogated carrier exercised that right, its right of subrogation, and took over or took ownership of the subrogated claim for any outstanding medical expenses, the liability for that was extinguished, and the amount of their payment is the maximum amount that the subrogated carrier can collect.
Why not?
The subrogated carrier cannot collect more than it's paid
Well, who's really going to get the difference between 98 and 66? Isn't it the plaintiff and plaintiff's counsel? Yet the insurance company isn't going to get more than its subrogated interest. I don't think anybody's arguing that.
If this court, within its power, decides to extend the collateral source rule to a situation as we have here, subrogation, exercise of subrogation, no waiver of subrogation, you're absolutely correct, Your Honor. If the law is changed as it's set forth in the Lambert case.
But how does this case differ from Ellsworth?
Ellsworth, there is a remainder interest, Your Honor. There is a remainder interest provided under statute. So the statute dictated what the situation was in that case. In the Ellsworth case, the statute provided, Your Honor, that first would be paid the cost of collection, including attorney's fees. Then the lien of the medical care of the governmental entity would be paid, and then there would be a remainder interest left over for the benefit of the injured person. And this court, and in that decision, ruled that because of that remainder interest, the collateral source rule would apply. In fact, in page 684 of the court's decision, Your Honor, it was stated that the collateral source rule is to prevent the liability of a tortfeasor to an injured person from being reduced, to an injured person, from being reduced by reason of payments or benefits received by the injured person from a third party. But, Your Honor, in this particular case, that isn't what happened. The Wisconsin Central, as the subrogated carrier, took that basket of liability for those medical bills and satisfied it, extinguished that liability, and it was done. So the collateral source rule, Your Honor, based upon the present law, would not apply.
Well, let's assume, counsel, that in this case you did not have those issues about whether or not any of the treatment received was not due to this accident. And so and in this case, everybody, let me give you a hypothetical case.
Sure.
Everybody agrees that all the injuries were due to this to an accident, okay? And because of the fortuitous circumstance that the plaintiff's company had a special contract with the hospital, they paid $66,000 for her medical treatment. Whereas if somebody else, not in the same position as the plaintiff, didn't have that kind of contract, beneficial insurance contract, they would have had to pay $187,000. And the testimony would so reflect that the testimony says the reasonable value of those services was $187,000. And that's what she would have normally had to pay, but for the fact that she had a beneficial insurance contract. Under those circumstances, would the plaintiff be entitled to the full $187,000 or just the amount that she paid, under your arguments?
If, Your Honor, if the injured party has the responsibility for those bills, or even if an insurance company paid it but waived subrogation, the collateral source rule, Your Honor, under the present law of this state, would apply. But once the subrogated carrier steps forward, takes that obligation, and extinguishes the liability and takes it away from the plaintiff, then under the present law, Your Honor, the collateral source rule does not apply because there is no claim or cause of action in favor of the injured plaintiff at that point in time. It's gone.
So your whole argument depends on this subrogation. If you had the same situation in this case, but there was no insurance, and the doctor and hospital agreed to cut their bills, for you, we understand you're going to be made destitute, so we're not going to charge you $187,000. We're going to charge you $67,000. No insurance. The Kaufmans pay $67,000 and then sue for the extra $120,000. No subrogation. Let's eliminate the question. That, I think, is just as bad as this question. Let's eliminate the issue about causation of the accident for the damage. could the Kaufmans recover anything? No subrogation.
If subrogation isn't in the contract, it's a so-called investment of contract, that type of situation, and if the bills were $180 and the carrier without subrogation paid $60, would Mr. Kaufman have a right to make that claim?
Forget insurance. This guy has no insurance.
Sure. Absolutely.
Absolutely what?
Absolutely, the Claros Source rule would be a rule that could be applicable to that situation. With the
so
proviso,
how much would Kaufman get? Kaufman sues the defendant. What does he get under those conditions?
The amount that the jury finds...
Reasonable.
Right.
Okay, and let's just assume that's $187,000. So he could collect the difference, which is roughly $60,000, right? $120,000.
Your Honor, I think...
The reasonable value is $187,000.
Who paid the $60,000, the individual?
Mr. Kaufman, personally. No insurance, no subrogation.
Has the liability been extinguished because of that payment?
There is no liability. The bill came in for $6,000, and that was the deal. That reasonable value was $180,000. At 66. I'm trying to isolate out if this is a subrogation case, a reasonable value case, was collateral source, this collateral source rule. I mean, you got three rules here, and I'm trying to tease out which one you're relying on. I hear you relying on subrogation, which makes sense. The insurance company owns the claim under the insurance policy. Their claim is only for the $66,000. They get the $66,000. Now they seem to be assigning something back to the plaintiff, and you're saying, what is it? It's disappeared now.
Right.
I understand that argument. So that's a subrogation-based argument, to my way of thinking. That doesn't mean that others will agree as to that. So now I'm trying to get it out of subrogation. See what happens then.
Well, we have the Oliver case, Your Honor, a court of appeals decision that has to be considered where the individual filed bankruptcy. And in that case, the court of appeals said no. That injured plaintiff could not claim the benefit of the collateral source rule because by his actions, he terminated that liability. Now, in your situation, it's a little bit more complicated. And my feeling is that if the bills were $183 and the plaintiff made a deal for $62, that I think it's an evidence situation different than this case. I mean, every case, as the court knows, is prepared differently based upon what the law and what you're faced with at that time. Maybe experts would have been brought in to check. Why it was made in this case. We talk about retail value and wholesale value and things like that, but I'm not sure, but I didn't feel it was my obligation to go into that at trial. I had an obligation to show a subrogation in a contract that payments were made and that they had a right of reimbursement which was not waived, and that's what we did here in the evidence in this case. And I was surprised when Judge Buzzi opened it up to this other proof, but I mean, that's not so easy to be a judge under these circumstances. That's the way I feel.
Could I ask you, Mr. Herrick, you talked about extinguishing liability. Your opposing counsel talked about other expenses, travel expenses, things like that. Is there evidence of other expenses in the record that were not extinguished?
Your Honor, Mr. Kaufman received by stipulation the amount that he was claiming with respect to unreimbursed medical expenses. And as far as this argument about loss of earning capacity, the record shows that the claim for loss of earning capacity Mr. Kaufman asserted in this case was a lot larger than the amount that the jury awarded, a lot larger.
Counsel, I made reference earlier to this recent Court of Appeals case, Reed versus Bradley. That's, I think, right on issue in this case. And it follows up what the Chief and Justice Babbage were asking, and it says,
There's no question that a plaintiff who's been injured by another person's torturous conduct is entitled to recover the reasonable value of his or her medical costs occasioned by the injury. And the test is the value of those costs, not the actual charge. And then the next sentence, which picks up what the Chief and Justice Babbage was saying. In our view, State Farm, that's the one that had to subrogate, in our view, State Farm's agreement to settle its limited subrogation claim for less than its face value is analogous to the situation where a health care provider sets an injured plaintiff's broken bone for less than the reasonable cost. And the court, in its published decision, says that they can get the full value rather than what the value that was actually charged.
That's correct, Your Honor. If the plaintiff, when the plaintiff goes to trial, owns that cause of action.
Indeed, in this case, it was the subrogated carrier that owned the case. Are you familiar with that case?
No, I'm not, Your Honor.
Now, what about the Thorson case where it was gratuitous? Court said, okay, you can think it can recover the reasonable value that was provided gratuitously. Do you think that harms the case, Mr. Herrick?
No, because this was not a case that involved subrogation. It was a payment by a governmental entity. The minor was injured. The mother incurred the expense. It was payment by a governmental entity, and there was not any subrogation in that case. I think the Ellsworth case is a closer one to our situation than that, Your Honor.
This Reed case cites Thorson for the proposition. The reason underlying the rule is that the recovery of medical costs has a penal effect on a tortfeasor who should not receive the advantage of gratuities from third parties, Thorson versus Milwaukee Suburban. Isn't that applicable to this case, that rationale?
The rationale is applicable, but it does not relate, Your Honor, to that part of the medical claim that has been assumed by the subrogated carrier, which, by reason of the law of subrogation, stands in the place of the injured party as far as those liabilities. And then when the subrogated carrier went out and made its deal, which did benefit State Farm, I'm not claiming that, but when it went out and made its deal for whatever reason, the subrogated carrier was limited, in this case, to reimbursement as to the amount that it paid. And what's being attempted here is we're saying, even though the liabilities were extinguished, even though by reason of the law of subrogation, that claim has been assigned over to the subrogated carrier, what we're going to do is let the plaintiff assert a claim thereafter for the difference and receive the benefit of it under the collateral source doctrine, and that hasn't been the law of the state of Wisconsin.
So you're arguing that the measure of damages where subrogation is present and has been asserted and has not been waived is whatever was paid or incurred by the subrogated carrier, and that in all other cases it's reasonable value. To focus on the measure of damage question that's involved in this case.
Except for maybe the Oliver case, yes, Your Honor, and that's clear from a case I failed to cite in my brief, the D'Angelo case, and it's clear I did cite another case in my brief that is for that proposition, but that would be the limitation there, Your Honor.
What, and this gets to one of the issues that I'm... Now, of course, the jury instructions don't establish the law. We do, but hopefully they correctly reflect the law. I want to focus on the word incurred. What does that mean? I know that the law of damages in Wisconsin, citing Reed versus Bradley, states an injured party can also recover for full medical expenses incurred even if that party's insurer settles its subrogation claim for less than the face value. Does incur mean charged, or does incur mean paid, or what is it? If I go to a hospital and the bill is $100,000, is that the
is that what's incurred in expenses? But the hospital agrees, because I'm so nice, so you only charge me 50 cents on the dollar, and so I only have to pay $50,000. What does incurred mean? The amount that I pay or the amount that is reasonably charged?
Your Honor, I'm glad you asked that question. The word, the definition of the word incurred was defined in the QR case that was cited by appellants. It's that case out of the Supreme Court of the State of Virginia. And in that case, they define the word incurred as being either an obligation paid or an obligation that someone has liability for.
So this law of damages book would be incorrect in citing Reed versus Bradley for an injury can also an injured party can also recover for full medical expenses incurred even if that party's insurer settled its subrogation claim for less than its face value. That is incorrectly using the term incurred?
No, Your Honor. No, because it wasn't incurred. Once the subrogated carrier pays for that, pays that liability, satisfies that liability, and asserts the right of subrogation, it's not incurred by the plaintiff. It's incurred by the subrogated carrier because the subrogated carrier stands in the place of the plaintiff. You see, and that's where Ellsworth is different, because under the statute in Ellsworth, there was a remainder interest. The statute provided cost of collection, including attorney's fees, then payment to the governmental entity, and then the remainder would be paid to the individual. But that's not what, there is no remainder in this case. The subrogated carrier, Wisconsin Central, stepped in the place of, substituted itself for those liabilities. We had no idea if they'd pay 62, 180. We had no idea what they'd pay. And that's just the law, and that's the way the case is presented.
Can I ask one other question?
Yes, sir.
It seems to me that you could construct a policy argument against paying reasonable value when reasonable value is much higher than what was actually incurred. I don't see you constructing any kind of policy argument. You're just talking about sort of the operation of the law in subrogation situations. You don't. There's no talk about,
because Your Honor, the case, and that's a good question. Because the case was presented by the defense in these circumstances based upon what we understand the law to be. Had I thought that the law was different, maybe I would have gone into why this big reduction, what was going on there. I mean, you start wondering, now, why would somebody walk away from $120,000? And so that's why I just don't feel comfortable when it's not in the record making that kind of an argument, Your Honor.
And I'm sorry to be so obtuse here, but is the $187,000 in the record that the jury heard or not?
Yes, Your Honor. The testimony of Dr. Maimon was read by Judge Buzley from Dr. Maimon's deposition into the record. Exhibit 1 was put into the record, totaled all the bills. This is on the record. And then the parties were allowed to argue their positions, including the amounts that were paid, which under Lambert is proper, under page 108 of Lambert.
But the jury wasn't given any instruction about what it was, how it was to evaluate those two different numbers.
It was just given the standard instruction.
Now, but do you think we should maybe not send this back and let them take a look at it under a new trial?
If the court would change the law, as I understand it, to be in subrogation relationship to the collateral source under these circumstances, I think that the jury award was based upon the evidence with the pre-existing problems, the testimony of Dr. Porter, et cetera. I think the jury verdict had tremendous credibility and substance, and there was support for it. That's just what the record shows. This man had a lot of problems before our accident ever came along. And there's a serious question whether or not any of his problems related to the accident.
But that 98,000 figure for medical expenses was an arbitrary number insofar as there was no expert testimony to support it, right? I mean, all the there were the bills to the extent of 187, there was the 60-whatever amount, but nothing in between.
Well, I can speculate that if they thought half of this individual's damages were related to his pre-existing problems, that they probably try to split it down the middle without a calculator, but who am I to, I mean, it's not a record, it's just pure speculation.
The circuit court reduced that jury award.
Yes, so based upon Lambert.
Right, so your position is we should affirm the circuit court,
not reinstate
the $98,000.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And not grant $187,000 or whatever that number is.
Right, because if the law on Lambert has changed, one more issue is going to be created. Under Garrity and Rhymes, the subrogated carrier takes after the plaintiff is made whole. So if you want to assign the benefit of the bargain on a claim or relief that the subrogated carrier owns back in some fashion to the plaintiff, you put the subrogated carrier back one more step in the theory of recovery.
So you're saying if you did that, then the plaintiff would argue the reasonable value is in excess of what was actually paid out. Plaintiff would get that extra sum, and subrogated insurance company would get even less, maybe less than it paid out.
I'm saying if there's limited coverage, the plaintiff is going to say, I'm entitled to this, plus the difference between what the subrogated carrier paid and the amount billed, and then the subrogated carrier takes. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Counsel. What do you have to say about that?
I don't think this case is the maverick that defense counsel makes it out to be. I think that the rules that have come from, 70-some years of case law can be easily reconciled with this case. There is ample precedent holding that insurance payments are a collateral source. And I hesitate to use insurance because we have an employee health benefit plan, which is not necessarily an insurance, but nonetheless there are some analogies between them. And this court reaffirmed in Ellsworth that this court recognizes insurance as a collateral source, and in essence medical assistance was akin to insurance for the needy. Defense counsel represents that the present law, he keeps talking about the present law. I think this court has an opportunity to state, what is the present law? I think the present law is that it's the reasonable value of medical expenses necessitated by an accident. Lambert doesn't change that. Lambert, in fact, has very limited application. It applies to the situation. Say, for example, here our $66,000 was not pursued within the statute of limitations. If Lambert would have any application, it would allow for a credit to the defendants in the amount of that subrogated claim. That's not the case here. This case is directly on fours with the Ellsworth case. We have a situation where the amount charged versus the amount actually paid, there's a disparity, and there's a reason for that disparity. And this court knows that in today's complicated healthcare system and managed care plans, that there are a variety of charges circulating around. They're dependent on who the particular provider is and who the insurance company or employee benefit plan may be. You know what? The plaintiff has no control over that. So should plaintiff Medicare, plaintiff Medicaid patient, plaintiff insurance patient, should the reasonable value be different? No, I disagree with defense counsel that this case is somehow different because we have a subrogated claim capable of being pursued. And I think this court has the opportunity to address Lambert and distinguish it from the facts in this case and make it clear that just because we have a subrogation interest doesn't wholly negate the collateral source rule. If anything, it only affects the amount subject to that subrogation claim. And
here's my problem. What doesn't that mean in every case the plaintiff can argue that the value was more than charged for one reason or other?
More than charged. So when you say charged, you mean billed?
Billed.
Well, that's not the case here. There never would have been an argument that it was beyond what was charged or billed. We have a difference between what was actually collected, if you will. I think that's the subject of medical testimony, and I think that's what Ellsworth clarifies, is that the plaintiff has the burden of proving what is the reasonable and necessary value. And if there's any controverting testimony, then it's a jury issue.
But ordinarily, it's the amount that's billed.
Arguably, it can be. Arguably, it can be. The methodology for determining medical...
Just
sure.
One question. Then we, if that's what the jury should do, and I'm uncertain that the jury actually did that here, would you be saying that we should send this back for a new trial just on the issue of damages?
Are you asking me whether?
In other words, we would vacate the special verdict of $98,000,
right,
and hold that if we held your way that the collateral source rule would apply, and then send this back so the jury could take a look at the damages, just on that one issue.
Yeah, yes, Your Honor, absolutely. And I think it should be made clear, if that, in fact, is the remedy that this court decides to issue, I think it should be made clear that the jury should not hear the amount actually paid. And that's consistent with cases that say collateral sources. That information should not go to the jury because that's prejudicial information. In this case, obviously, there was heightened prejudice because the judge then reaffirmed what was paid to the jury. So if, in fact, the court does do that and remand this case for retrial of that issue, I would ask that the court make it clear that the jury not hear that type of information, because I believe this case is a case in point in terms of what can happen when a jury hears X amount and Y amount, but no one is allowed to argue why there's a difference. They're kind of left in this vacuum of medical charges, if you will.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Harris. That completes the hearing on 99.